This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
How humans came to construct their world is shaped in large part by the nature and extent of shelter. And when we consider how humans access shelter in the modern era, three predominant pathways emerge. First, individuals may hire professionals to design and build new homes, following formal processes. Second, people rent or buy existing homes within a regulated housing market. Third, and perhaps the most telling of economic and social disparity, is the reality faced by over 1 billion impoverished people who self-build their own homes, brick by brick, out of necessity and for survival. Beginning in the mid-20th century, in the wake of rapid rural to urban migration, these homes were often constructed on public or private land that was initially squatted outside formal legal frameworks. Over time, if not displaced by government intervention, what are referred to as Brazilian favelas, barrios, or shanty towns in other parts of Latin America evolve into consolidated neighborhoods, reflecting resilience and community-driven urbanization. This self-construction process that I've been studying speaks to the powerful human drive to create shelter and community, or what architect John Turner termed housing as a verb, even in the face of systemic exclusion from formal housing markets. Although initially seen as an urban aberration and never anticipated to survive, these so-called spontaneous settlements now cover approximately 30% of all large cities in Latin America. But how do you begin to study these places? They've become a fundamental part of the urban landscape, but they're unmapped. So my focus in a study that the NSF did like was on how different shelters interact and reinforce one another in settlements in São Paulo, Brazil. And I was focused, although there are around 5,000 settlements in São Paulo, I was focused on settlements that are called consolidated. They're around 40 to 50 years old, and also where state-led upgrading or redevelopment projects have been concentrated. And so you'll see the two settlements. Heliópolis is around 12 kilometers from the city center, and then the other settlement, Jardim São Francisco, which is about 22 kilometers from the city center. So there's an inner suburban and a peri-urban settlement that I studied. But as people are building their homes in these areas, it's not just about technical advance. They're also constructing a spatial politics, or what Henri Lefebvre termed a right to the city, a right to change ourselves by changing the city. And this concept emerged from social movements resisting inequitable conditions that capitalism imprinted on cities, culminating in events like the 1967 Paris riots. And during that time, Lefebvre envisioned an urbanism that could radically transform where and how people lived in cities, particularly in neighborhoods that have been overlooked or devalued by modernist functionalist planning. Lefebvre inspired a radical turn in architects, planners, and grassroots movements toward the idea that informal settlements, places outside of formal norms, were not only areas where marginalized people could access urban resources and opportunities, but also as strategic spaces for asserting their right to participate in the design, planning, and actual construction of the city itself. But now these rights-based built environments are under siege. In my research across Latin America, I've observed a concerning trend that threatens the very foundation of the pact we call a right to the city. In many inner suburban settlements, the majority of homesteads are being transformed into rental properties. So whereas in 2010, the majority of homesteads were owner-occupied and owned, now the majority is rental. And in the absence of a regulatory ecosystem, these areas are experiencing a profound transformation. The rise of unregulated rental real estate is not only altering the social fabric of these communities, but also eroding the very architectural and collective foundations upon which these settlements were built. But this is somewhat of a paradox, because rental was never part of the plan for self-builders or for planning in the first place. sociologist Lucio Kowalric and Clara Ant called the inner city rental tenements an insalubrious architecture, while the favelas were a place of refuge. But the favelas were also seen as a form of disorder. And of course, at the same time as favelas were emerging in the mid-20th century, you have modernist architecture designed to order these places that were considered disordered, as well as order the people who live there. So you can see these projects, such as the Pedregulho Social Housing Project in Rio de Janeiro. Although there were also alternative models, such as the Escola Parque, and this was an urbanism model designed to evolve as informal settlements around them developed. This is, for example, one large modernist structure, but again, the inside was always meant to be adapted. This movement toward the bottom-up or collective as a form of urbanism was highlighted by Italian architect Lina Bobardi in the 1956 volume of Habitat, and in it she suggested that cities begin with spaces of learning. This idea of the Escola Parque and urbanisms that co-evolve between formal and informal, or this a gradient versus a dichotomy, there was a missed opportunity to install these kinds of projects in Sao Paulo. In 1950, on Sao Paulo's anniversary, there was essentially a divergence of funds to build 50 Escola Parques on the periphery of Sao Paulo in order to curb more informality and to promote bottom-up urbanization. And these funds were directed, of course, to the famous Ibirapuera Park. This park was designed by these big bad architectures we just heard about, Oscar Niemeyer, and are, of course, grand. However, they in many ways dismantled this emergence of a rights-based urbanism that could have been. At the same time, there was a sanitation movement and rent controls of tenement cortiços in urban centers. And this tenement flight that followed fueled a freedom to build on urban peripheries. What happened was the rise of what is called Maria Huchi Amaral de Sampaio, called the ant constructors, because they consumed so much of the construction industry with millions of small bites. And these formed these low-income suburbs called the Lachimentos. And you can see here how the evolution of the Cantinho do Sil, Lachimento in Sao Paulo, between 1962 and 1994, dramatic patterns of urbanization. However, there was an uneven development of informality and a rise of what is called the favela. And while Lachimentos are somewhat planned informal suburbs, favelas form irregularly on leftover plots of land, tend to be more dense. Again, back to the idea of a right to the city. Within the favelas, because of the lack of infrastructure, there was a convergence of social movements for basic services and housing improvements in favelas. With the rise of the left, and we see, of course, the election of the PT, the redemocratization movements that went on across Latin America, but particularly in Brazil with the election of Lula da Silva in 2001 and then re-election. So how did the architecture of informality, how was it shaped by a right to the city? In contrast to the modern movement, the rise of the postmodern turn and pre-existing territories, or what we would call today adaptive reuse, came into being. And of course, Lina Bobardi finally got her way in the early 80s with the Sesc Pompeia Leisure Center. From this same perspective was the idea of the mutirão, which is a form of half housing or core housing in which a government an infrastructural plenum is constructed and people are permitted to build out their home as their time and resources permit. Informality then becomes sanctioned. Governments realize that there's no way to actually build enough housing for the rise of population, and they begin to implement upgrading or slum upgrading strategies, which work by essentially removing the worst parts of slums and redeveloping them with revitalization projects. These are some examples from Bambujao and the Cantagalo in Rio de Janeiro, but they tend to be sensitive densification infill projects within existing environments. The limited scope of upgrading led self-building to prevail, and what ultimately happened was greater demolition of settlements that were very dense. A key moment occurred when rental entered into the picture, but not by choice. In the mid-2000s, most municipalities who were preparing for the World Cup and the mega events happening after 2010, they were economically flush. I don't know who remembers the cover of the Economist article in Economist issue in 2007, but the Christ was taking off. And so Brazil was flush, and they displaced more people than they were eventually able to build housing. But what remained was a rental voucher. And this rental voucher stream began to, it created an unprecedented resource stream that was channeled into apartments built and managed by the informal sector. At the same time, there was much default, construction default, project default for social housing, a resquatting of previously cleared slums, and rental housing is forged from past informal architectures. The rental turn. So what becomes very interesting in the story is how different actors become landlords, not just owners, not just organized crime, but a gradient of actors, and how they change their built environments in ways to expand their livelihood. There are five patterns of rentier entrepreneurism in Brazilian favelas. The first pattern involves family plus rent. So you can see an original family home in the first two stories and just a two-story topper. The family remains on site. Their commitment is to live in the community that they've built over time, but they're simply adding another two stories of rental, and the two spaces are separated by a dedicated staircase to the right, which is the telltale sign of the addition of rental. In the second pattern, by contrast, the goal is entirely different. The family has built out a large structure early on, and they reduce their footprint within that structure and eventually move out, either to manage the asset from afar or to sell it. In pattern three, is a collective consortium. And in this case, the building people do together what they may not be able to do separately. They pool their resources and divide up a building in ways to optimize the economics of that building for their livelihoods. In this case, you also have the addition of several entrances to facilitate the division of that building. In the fourth pattern, the Senhorio Cortiço, or the Slumlord Cortiço, the tenants actually build their own floors. And one resident describes this type as apartments that require wings to access. So tenants will build their floors, floor by floor, just like shacks, but they're verticalized, and strap a metal staircase, a round staircase, or a ladder to the building as it grows. And so you can see that staircase sort of rising through the building. In pattern five, which is an entirely unprecedented type, a new mixed-use building is constructed in the place of an underdeveloped shack. So instead of focusing upon how buildings can be consolidated, in this case, the opposite is true. The goal is to look for underdeveloped shacks where people are clearly in distress. These projects tend to be developed by various actors, from external investors to organized crime. But the catch is that they sweeten the deal and make an offer that probably cannot be refused. They offer the residents a cash payment, 6 months of a rental voucher, and a gifted unit in the new building. In exchange, they beautify the neighborhood. They create a building in 6 months, And as a comparison, it takes about 10 years to build 250 units by the state. So it's a very, very quick process and provides housing in ways that governments have been unable to do thus far. These rental types vary spatially between inner suburban and peri-urban settlements. So you can begin to see how the density of Eliopolis, where you have very tall buildings, row house types, contrasts with the horizontality of San Francisco, where the lots are larger and the same types are able to spread out on larger plots of land. Are these types simply bespoke shelters in an informal settlement, or are they something bigger? So one of the questions that we sought to answer is, how do these different types vary between actors who are present in informal settlements today? And so what we find is the original owners are the largest share of rental entrepreneurs, followed by secondary owners and inheritance. But what's interesting here is that the two type one, where people stay in the settlement, and type four, where they leave, where you have situations of absentee owners, compromise the majority, the largest share of rental redevelopment. The type three collective consortium, where you have mixes of, for example, single mothers, we've seen non-familial members grouping together. So these are all models that we can begin to think about in terms of tenure and how tenure and land are becoming mixed within this larger landscape of rental redevelopment. And in terms of reflections on what does this mean for the future of informality, one interesting dimension of the redevelopment of self-built housing is the creation of an entirely new construction ecosystem. As you can see in this image, the new buildings use two-way construction, which permits a much larger span, and all in all are much safer structures to ensure health, safety, and welfare of residents. So that is a plus. At the same time, as we've seen, this architecture of informality is deeply uneven. It's more than a collection of makeshift houses. It's a social and now an economic fabric woven from collective action, cultural expression, and political resistance. It is fundamentally about people's claim to the right to the city, the right to shape their environments and to participate in urban life on their own terms. So what began as a grassroots movement with people self-building their homes on the urban peripheries has become a powerful assertion of vulnerable communities as agents of their own survival. But today, as this vision is changing, and this is a challenge and opportunity, the rise of rental housing and commercial interests does expand the livelihoods of people who have labored their entire life. But it also erodes the original communal spirit that once defined these spaces. So how can we take rental housing to the next level, closer to the rights-based origins where it began? Our field, architecture, has a critical role to play in advocating for urban justice that prioritizes the agency, dignity, and resilience of these communities, to move beyond just the physical structures of informal housing to tensions between the social worlds they create and the economic activities they embody. My lab is working in three areas. One, using the rental housing lab in the Heliopolis favela, to understand how rental housing is impacting tenants and tenants' rights. The second area is to develop alternate models of urban co-creation using citizen science and what I call situated data. So making maps of rental, where it's located, and documenting the conditions. And finally, community-led cooperative rental housing, a third way. So neither social housing and neither self-built housing, but something in the middle that actually is intentional about how rental shapes where and how people live in cities. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.